Support comes from Aventiv Research. People who are 18 or older and haven't had a pneumococcal vaccine may qualify to participate in a clinical study to evaluate if an investigational vaccine helps to protect against pneumococcal disease. Learn more at AventivResearch.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Wilds is one of the largest and most popular animal and ecological conservation parks in the country. Located 75 miles east of Columbus, the 10,000-acre spread has undergone massive transformations from its prehistoric beginnings to farmland, to strip mining for coal, and now reclamation. A new documentary chronicles the past, present, and future of the Wilds. How the area transitioned over the years is the subject of 10,000 Acres by our guest. Denison University professor Doug Swift directed 10,000 Acres. Doug Swift, welcome to All Sides.
Well, thanks for having me, Ann. It's great to be here.
I can't wait to watch this because I was around, you know, and know about the big shovel during the when they were scraping away the earth to mine the coal, and then when the Wilds came about. But what was before? What I wondered how curious you were about the before times, even before white people came around.
Yeah, I really wanted to go backwards. So right before the shovel was the farming community, and that story is really interesting. And then I really wanted to get the beginning of that story, which was, you know, the very first people. And I specifically found one family, the Spillman family, who I was, that just for whatever reason, that's the family. And where their farm was is kind of in the heart of, if you take the bus tour, you know, they drop you off for a little while, and that's right in front of Spillman Lake, and that's where the Spillman farm was. But I'm able to trace their history all the way back to even before they came from Pennsylvania to Meigs Township. But I wanted to imagine, like, how did they get from Pennsylvania to Meigs Township? You know, there's not roads. There's not an inn that they can stop at. And then they get there, and there's just this massive, massive forest of old-growth trees, right? And they've got to get a crop of corn planted as soon as possible to get through the winter. And the deforesting of those massive old-growth trees, that's kind of the first stripping,
right
that happened on the land. So then you go back before that, and of course there were what we call historical tribes that we might think of, the Wyandotte and the Delaware and the Shawnee, but there are mound builders there, the Adena and Hopewell. So 2,000 years back.
On the 10,000 acres?
On the 10,000 acres. One is extant. One is still there. Only because that farmer, John Few, had sold his farm to a gas line company, and there are gas lines there. So they had to strip mine around his farm. They couldn't strip.
Okay, the gas line saved the mounds.
Saved the mound.
Wow.
So that mound is still there. It's been worn down because they just cultivated right over it. But it, nonetheless, it's still there. And all the others, you know, they would just strip mine right through them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Wilds today. It's history. It's prehistoric history, what we know about its farming, the legacy of farming there, and how it was strip mined, and going forward, as it's now one of the largest and most popular ecological conservation parks in the country. My guest is Denison University professor Doug Swift. He directed a new documentary that chronicles all those stages of what is now known as the Wilds. The documentary is titled 10,000 Acres. If you have a question or comment, Did you grow up around there? Do you know about the Wilds? Do you have a question about the Wilds? Now is your chance to get your question answered. 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You worked with 100 Days in Appalachia. That's a regional online news source on this project. How did those roles work? What did you do? What did they do? What was the purpose?
So I'm a big fan of these nonprofit media sites, right?
Yeah.
So I that's who I called when I wanted to pitch the story. And Ashton Mera is the executive editor there. So I told Ashton, I said, I think I have either a little story or maybe it's a bigger story. And the little story was now that it's, you know, been mined and reclaimed, you know, where the famous part of the Wilds, where the exotic animals are, that's only, you know, maybe a fifth or so of all that land. The rest is, you know, what they call, you know, ecological land where they're trying to reconstitute ecologically. And because there's grasslands there, there's these grassland birds that have taken refuge there. And I thought that was a fascinating story. So I wanted to do a story about the Henslow sparrow. And she said, "Eh, I mean, that's interesting."
Was she a bird hater?
But we think, you know, when I told her about the big muskie, and I told her about the farmers, and of course the endangered species, she said, "Yeah, I think you need to do the whole thing."
Okay.
But I didn't know how to do it. Like, I just didn't see how a 90-minute documentary film, how you could jump so, you know, from one subject to the other. And she's the one who told me how I could do it, which is make an interactive website oriented documentary where they're just little chapters or little pages. And so you make mini documentaries about each subject, and you can almost, you know, like a book or something, you can go from chapter to chapter. So she really provided the format of the project, and then with us working together, then we were able to get grants from the Ohio Humanities Council, the Ohio Arts Council, and so on.
I think the bird story is interesting because it's ironic that it was not native to that area, but because of the because of what farming and big farming has done to the country's prairie land, it has decided to take up residence in the reclaimed strip mining property.
Right. Yes, it's very ironic, and it represents kind of where we're at as humans in our relationship with nature. And we have to help, but sometimes when we help, we have unintended consequences. and so it's all of that. In this sort of magical thing where these birds are just sort of magical, mystical creatures. So, yeah, I love that story for that reason. To me, it's still a little bit of the heart of the whole story.
Yeah.
But I have to agree that it's much more effective now in the context of the larger story.
Because sometimes I thought when they reclaimed it, they took it back. They took it to prairie land versus, well, at the very early times when they started to reclaim it back in the 30s, I guess, they would plant these olive bushes or something. And what was the problem with that?
Well, now you're getting to a sore subject.
Oh.
Well, they were, and to AEP's credit, they started reclaiming in 47.
Okay.
And they started, their goal was to reforest. And they were doing this even though there were no laws that required them to do that. And it wasn't just, they weren't just planting one kind of tree. They were actually doing this sort of three basket method where the first basket was your fast growers that would, you
kind
know,
of start
establish
the little
root
ecosystems
systems
going, yeah.
And stop erosion. And then your second basket was your pulp woods that would fill things out. And then your third basket was your hard woods that would come in last, and in certain number of years then you could harvest them again, you know, and they put a lot into that, you know, and they didn't really need to. So to their credit, that was a pretty great system. But in that first basket, and nobody's taken credit for this for obvious reasons, but the Forest Service and different organizations were testing to see which tree would do best. And somebody had, this is another one of unintended consequences, you know, somebody had brought in autumn olive from Asia and was playing around with it and said, hey, this is a good bush, right? This, it grows fast. It's anti-erosion properties. It fixes nitrogen. It's got berries. And so it's really, the birds are going to like it. This is a great reclamation tree. And it was. Unfortunately, is a very, very aggressive invader. And right now, it's just the bane of
like honeysuckle.
Yes. And honeysuckle is another that they threw in the mix. And so those two are, but autumn olive actually outcompetes honeysuckle.
Because it's hard to get rid of. It's hard to pull out. Yeah.
It's awful.
Yeah.
And so it is now, going back to the bird story, you've got this wonderful preserve for the grassland birds, but now the autumn olive is pushing the birds out of that grassland.
Okay. The documentary is 11 chapters. It each focuses, as you described, on a specific aspect of the land and its occupants. What did you learn that surprised you? And that you hope people stick with it long enough to see and hear about.
Oh my gosh, I learned so much.
I bet.
I learned. To pick one theme, it's for one thing, it's just a great story, and just to pick a story through time that is focused on just one little patch of land and to watch it go through all these huge transformations.
Yeah. It's like epic.
It's just an epic story, you know? They're big things, you know? So when the big muskie came in, it's the biggest drag line ever built in the world.
Biggest,
you know?
Bucket shovel.
And then the wilds is one of the largest endangered species preserve in North America, right? So things on huge scales in this little out-of-the-way area in Muskingum County. So it's just a great story. But I learned a lot about people. I guess the chapter maybe that surprised me the most, I have a chapter in there called Visionaries. And it's about the two people most responsible for the wilds.
As it stands today.
And that idea came to me from Dan Beatum. And he's he's in charge of animal management out there at the wilds. And he said the two people most responsible for the wilds are Sam Speck and Bob Teeter. And I thought, well, that's quite a thing to say. And so I tested it out on Dorothy Montgomery, who we'll hear from shortly, and on a couple of other people who'd been around for a long time. And they both said, yeah, that sounds about right. And so Sam Speck is the person who wrote reclamation law. And so that was his part to play. And Bob Teeter is just, he was director of Ohio Department of Natural Resources.
Right.
And he just took it as a mission. And he did everything he had to do. He had to go out and convince the people who lived in that area that, you know, these animals weren't going to get out and destroy their. He did everything he had. He raised the money.
This is not Jurassic Park, you know. This is
exactly because people are like, yeah, "What you're going to put? What you're going?" Yeah. They thought lions and tigers and bears are going to, you know, roam and kill their livestock. And now these are two. Traditional Republican politicians of the 80s and 70s and 80s. And these are the visionaries. And I just came to really appreciate that. I think, you know, this is kind of referencing your first hour of your show today. I mean, I think maybe we've lost some of the dedication to big ideas. Yeah, well, good at, and also commitment to a public good or something like that, you know. You have to wonder if the wilds could be executed today. But they I took so much from them and that chapter in particular. But throughout the chapter, even though so much happens and so much changes, I just learned from the people and what they were doing at each part of the story.
That is Doug Swift. He's director of a new documentary. It is entitled The 10,000 Acres, and it is about what we all know of as the wilds. It's the largest endangered species preservation conservation park in the northern hemisphere. It's located 75 miles east of Columbus. It's a 10,000 acre spread. It's undergone massive transformations from its prehistoric beginnings, obviously, to farmland, to strip mining for coal, and now to preservation. We invite your questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Coming up, we're going to meet a Muskingum County resident who remembers her family farm before the strip mining came along. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The Wilds is one of the largest and most popular endangered species, animal, and ecological conservation parks in the country. Located 75 miles east of Columbus in Muskingum County, the 10,000-acre spread has undergone massive transformations from its prehistoric beginnings to farmland, to strip mining for coal, and now to preservation. A new documentary chronicles the past, present, and future of the Wilds. It's titled 10,000 Acres. And the director, Doug Swift, is still with us. Dorothy Montgomery knew that 10,000 acres as a child before the strip mining and the reclamation. She's a lifelong resident of Muskingum County. Dorothy Montgomery, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you.
You grew up on a farm near or on the 10,000 acres, right?
The Wilds joins our farm on three sides, yes.
Okay. What was it like there before the mining?
Well, those were back in the Depression days in the 1930s. And everyone, we have a saying that everyone was poor, but we didn't know it because of the feeling of the folks and the values that they had. And the struggles that they had. If someone needed something, you shared whatever you had with them. And it was a difficult time because you're too young to know much about the Depression, but the banks had closed and folks had struggled is a good word. Mm-hmm.
And then the landmen from the coal companies started coming around and offering people, did I read this right, $1 an acre?
$1 an acre. Now, that was for the lease they paid.
Yeah, so it was.
And everyone accepted that $1 an acre. They were thrilled. If they had 30 acres, they just got $30 that they didn't count on. And my father did not do that, and people would say, oh, why? Why, that will pay your taxes. But he said, what if they come and pick that lease up? Oh, they won't. They've leased for oil and gas and different things down through the years, and they never pick up the leases, but they did.
How did it change the community there when they started scraping it away?
Oh, my. Well, at first the shovels and the drag lines weren't so, they were just normal size. But then when the big muskie came in many, many pieces by rail, and that in itself was an entertaining thing for nearly a year as they assembled it on one of the farms. And people came from miles around to watch that take place. But when it started walking, well, you should have seen the, I guess we would call it the electric cord that plugged in and made it run.
Mm-hmm.
It was enormous, and it just was breathtaking, really.
Kind of a tourist attraction, right?
Oh, yes, yeah. yes, definitely.
Yeah, I remember writing about that years ago. So how did it change the community, though? I mean, people left, right?
Well, they had to because right. they came back and picked up these leases. And some folks only got $25 or $35 an acre. But, you know, that became the... It was owned then by AEP or whatever, or Central Ohio Coal, whatever company it went under. I think there was a realtor that worked more or less on picking up those leases, Franklin Realty, as I recall. And once they picked it up, that was theirs. And then the farm sales began, the farm auctions. And our ladies at our little country Baptist church, Ark Spring Baptist, would have stands at those sales. You know, we'd have hot dogs and soup and lots of pies and things. And we made money that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because that they came in handy because most of the sales were all day.
So you lost families in that area that had been there for generations like yours, right?
Yes, our farm is a century farm, meaning, you know, for centuries. And it was my father's great-uncle Alex, A-L-E-X, Culbertson, fought in the Revolutionary War, and that was his pay. So many acres of farmland, and I'm sorry to say, I've often wondered how many acres he was given originally as his pay, but I've never done that.
There's probably a record of that. That's interesting. Doug Swift, what did you learn about how the community changed at the time?
Well, it was decimated. I mean, Dorothy's church is still there because it's across the street from the Wilds, what became the Wilds. But there were numbers of other churches that did not survive.
They were torn down, too.
They were torn down.
Wow.
And as well as the schools. There was I've done a lot of research in the archives, and then this whole thing about schools being moved and whether the children went to the Chandlersville school or the Cumberland school, and
so it split the community up that way as well.
So these are the people left who were just outside of the the property. So it was a lot of turmoil, and the people who tried to hang on, who didn't sell or waited to sell as long as possible, you know, then they were, Jean Ann Allen is another person who participated in the project. Her father hung on as long as possible. So then she's left out there, you know, with no neighbors, no friends,
right.
You know, as long as possible. So it created an awful lot of turmoil. Dorothy, did it affect the membership of your church?
Well, as he was saying, we had, at that time, when it all started, we had six churches in Meigs Township, which basically is the Wilds. And we lost the four Methodist churches. And we still had the Presbyterian, High Hill Presbyterian, which is active today. And we still have Ark Spring Baptist, yes. Typical country churches that the Ark Spring has a large cemetery. It is right in the center of the township, and many people choose to come back there for burial. Mm. And there are other cemeteries, but then in most cases the trustees, township trustees, have to care for them because there is no church affiliation at all.
Dorothy, what happened to the farmers who didn't sell their land, or leased their land, I should say, to the to AAP, or its forerunner, for the strip mining? Did strip mining affect the quality of the soil on the farms that remained, or was there any other kind of impact like that?
Well, I guess the thing that I'm fighting today on our farm is the erosion that comes down the valleys and the creeks, and it fills the creeks up. Mm-hmm. So consequently, our cropland is in deplorable condition because it floods so much. Mm-hmm. And it brings all this stuff, with a capital S, down the valleys. And
That's also because
a real problem. I remember just this last May we had a flood and the hay and things were on the top barbed wire of the fences. The water was so deep.
Wow.
That's also because they affected your water.
Well, they didn't our drinking water, because Daddy in 1930 established a spring and brought it to the house, except when some of the dirt covered the spring up, and then we had to drill wells. Yes.
Yeah, the runoff from the slurry from the mines is a horrible problem. It has been documented. So when they started to do the reclamation, I think back in the 70s and 80s, and turn it into prairie land, what were your thoughts about it at that point, Dorothy Montgomery?
Well, it was nice to see it being, leveled off. Well, I'm sure you're aware of ODNR now having mm-hmm. nearly, well, it is over 56,000 acres for this Appalachian park.
Right.
And some of that, of course, I heard you in the first segment talking about the autumn olive and the Wallflower right. rose and
yeah.
And honeysuckle, and my father, he really was thrilled with the multiflora rose, because they said that was going to be living fence, and we would never again have to put up a wire fence. And he often would say, and just to think, I paid perfectly good money for that stuff. And now it has just simply, oh, my. You know, the seeds for multiflora rose have to pass through the intestine of a bird.
Right.
In order for to be fruitful, and consequently, a bird sits on every fence post, and we have a multiflora rose on every fence. Oh, well, it isn't funny, but that's the way it is.
I have a question that maybe you can respond to from a caller, Dorothy. Hang on. Ed in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Ed.
Yeah. Back in 1925, I learned that there was I didn't learn it in 1925, but I learned about a naval airship that crashed in 1925, and it actually broke apart into three pieces and crashed over Noble County. And
when you say airship, are you talking about a plane or like one of the dirigibles?
Like a blimp, like a rigid airship.
Right. Dorothy, do you remember that?
No, I don't remember it. I've heard about it and seen lots of pictures of it. And we used to have a piece of it. Talk about a tourist attraction. That was it. Everybody flocked to the fall of the Shenandoah. And as you go down Interstate 71 toward Marietta, there is a little park and a monument to the to the falling and the death of all the staff
wow.
of the Shenandoah.
What were your thoughts about the Wilds when they made these proposals to the community? What did you think then, back in the olden day, you know, back in the early, I guess, 70s or early 80s?
I think it was the way that it was presented. There were a lot of, and I don't mean this to say anything unkind about Dr. Teeter, but it, I don't know just how they were publicized. That there was going to be a meeting in Caldwell, or there was going to be a meeting in Zanesville or something. And there was just a lot of talk and discussion about, well, I heard you say about how the animals would get out and roam the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember taking my father to the election when Sam Speck ran for the legislature. And my father was a staunch Democrat. He thought FDR walked on water because he brought to the area electricity and many good farm programs. And so when my father had lost both legs because of diabetes, and the girls on the at the election board would bring his ballots out to him at the car so he could vote, and they brought out Democrat votes or ballots, and he said, no, I want a Republican one this time, and they were flabbergasted. Why? Well, I want to vote for that Speck boy. That's just exactly how he said it.
Uh-huh.
Because Sam promoted reclamation, and he wanted those farms put back in as good a shape as they were when they started turning them upside down.
But that's not what happened.
Well, in most cases, we have beautiful meadows.
Mm-hmm.
And pasture land and things in some areas, yes. Oh, it never was level.
Well, that was one of those unintended consequences, because he did. Sam was a farm boy, and he wanted it. He wanted them to put it back because they were leaving high walls and spoil piles.
Oh, yes.
So he wanted them to reshape the earth and plant it in grass. And then farmers could come back and you could reuse the land.
Okay.
The problem was that to do that, you have to go back and forth so many times with these massive bulldozers that the soil became so compacted,
right.
You can't plant anything on that.
So, right.
Except autumn olive.
Autumn olive
and honeysuckle.
Honeysuckle. Dorothy, I'm going to take a quick call before I let you go. Mike in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Real quick, I wanted to see if Doug had come across this in his research. If he had heard, I don't know, it must have been late 80s, early 90s, that Longaberger Baskets wanted to put an amusement park out that direction. And I was a commercial photographer, and I was hired to fly in a helicopter around that area and photograph the land. And Longaberger Basket, you know, blew up the pictures and put on a presentation, I'm not sure to who. But we landed right there on the hilltop at the Wilds.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, I mean, obviously nothing came of it, but I just wondered if he had come across anything mm-hmm. about that. It couldn't have been the exact same land, because by the early 90s, that would have already been in process. So I just wondered if it was an adjacent area or if he heard anything about it.
Well, I'd love to. There were many ideas in the early days. So I have not heard of this. I'd love to hear more and see your photos.
It makes sense that someone thought about developing it with the Wilds eventually taking root there. Mike, thanks a lot for that call. Dorothy Montgomery, before I let you go, what do you think of the Wilds now, such as it is?
Oh, I love it. My husband was one of the first trustees of the wilds, and I'm just amazed, and Jan Raymer that is there now, and her knowledge, and it's just fantastic. It really is unbelievable.
Dorothy Montgomery, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate being asked. Thank you.
I'll see you tonight, welcome. Dorothy.
That's Dorothy Montgomery. She is a lifelong resident and former county commissioner in Muskegon County, where the Wilds is located, about 75 miles east of Columbus. It's a 10,000-acre spread. It's undergone massive transformations from its prehistoric beginnings to farmland, to strip mining for coal, and now preservation as the Wilds. She referred to Jan Raymer, who is Senior Vice President of Animal Care and Conservation at the Columbus Zoo and the Wilds. Jan's going to join us, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Wilds we're talking about today. It's one of the largest and most popular animal and ecological conservation parks in the country. It's in Muskingum County, about 75 miles to the east of Columbus, and it's a 10,000-acre spread, but only a small part of it is what we know of as the Wilds. A new documentary chronicles the past, present, and future of the Wilds. We'll have a link on our website to tell you how to find that documentary on the web. Still with us is the director of the documentary 10,000 Acres, Doug Swift. Dr. Jan Raymer is Senior Vice President of Animal Care and Conservation at the Columbus Zoo and the Wilds. Dr. Jan Raymer, welcome back to All Sides.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here and thrilled to be talking about the Wilds.
Can you give us a thumbnail of what's at the Wilds and what it is? I know that's asking a lot, but just kind of what your elevator pitch is about what's there.
Oh, holy cow. So the Wilds is so much, and the thumbnail will be a very long thumbnail. But we are a conservation center, as you pointed out. We're on almost 10,000 acres of restored strip mining, surface mining, whatever you want to call it. And I was listening to Dorothy, who I adore, you were talking about reclamation, and I just want to make the distinction between reclamation and restoration. So right. We are also on restored prairie, where we have, and I think Doug talked about that a bit too, we've restored some of that land back to real prairie. So we've got about 2,000 acres where we have our exotic animals, and that's a drive-through safari park. People can come and go on open-air safaris or take a specialized truck that they go out and visit the animals. But these are animals that are threatened in their native habitat. And so these are assurance herds. We are very well known for our successful breeding programs of many of those animals. Southern white rhinos, this is one of the only places on earth where you can come out and drive right up to a southern white rhino. And
they're amazing.
Oh, they're amazing. And you truly feel like you're in Africa. But we're the only institution outside of Africa that has fourth and fifth generation southern white rhinos. So incredible success right here in southeastern Ohio. But in addition to that, we have overnight accommodations, which are wildly popular. So we have some yurts that you can stay in. Those sell out a year in advance. We have the Wilds cabins at Straker Lake that were funded by the very generous contributions of the Straker Charitable Foundation. And then we have a lodge. But we're also, and I think Doug might have pointed this out too, we are also building a new campground that was funded by an economic development grant. And that is going to transform the Wilds as well. So our goal is to get people out to visit our animals, to visit our pastures, to stay overnight, take advantage of the many fun things we have to do, but so that we can teach them about the things that they can do, just little lifestyle changes that might have an effect on conservation. so much more, but that's a good starter.
And compare and contrast the operation of a place like the Wilds with something like, you know, the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium.
Yeah, so the wild specialty is these large pastures so that we can accommodate large herds. And these are animal species that do better in large herds so that they can exhibit the widest range of natural behaviors. And that's why we see the breeding success that we do see in our southern white rhinos. And so that's our area of expertise, large pastures, large herds, mixed species. Now, we also have carnivores also that have large enclosures. So we're one of 10 cheetah breeding facilities, and we've had great success in breeding our cheetahs. We have African painted dogs and dholes, which I had never worked with until I came here. That's the Asian wild dog, basically. So yeah, that's our area of expertise. So the running of those, the way we manage those animals is different than the way they're managed in a traditional zoo.
I think about the balancing act of wanting to expose as many people as possible to what you're doing out in Muskingum County, but also maintaining the wilds as the refuge that it's intended to be.
That is a great comment and something that we're constantly thinking about. We see between 100 and 120,000 guests a year right now. And we certainly don't want to take away from the wonderful experience that people have right now by flooding people. But we also want to have as many people come out and have this experience as we can. So we're constantly thinking of new ways to give our guests that experience without diminishing the really special and unique experience that is the wilds. And I think the way we do that is with longer stays. So the campground is going to allow people to stay longer and offering more varied experiences. So we are looking into offering bird watching experience. And I haven't even talked about all the wonderful relationships we have with universities. We've been working with Muskingum University for years on the conservation of grassland birds. And so that is also an area of expertise. So yeah, I think getting guests to have specialized experience is one of the things that we're thinking about.
How was it decided what portion of the land would be dedicated to ecology compared, you know, versus, you know, animals?
Right. So I think when this first started, several species were picked based on need, and pastures were made based on the need of those species. And as we grew, pastures grew based on the species that we brought in. The 2,000 acres that are fenced in right now is a good large, it's a huge area for these animals. What we really, and the other thing that we are trying to do is understand the ecology of the region. We have a really strong restoration ecology department where we've been doing prairie restoration, wetland restoration, forest restoration, and we really feel like that's an important component of this land. You mentioned the Reclamation Act of 1977. Our North Country, where the campground is going, is pre-Reclamation Act. So there are still high walls up there. And so we've been working with partners through ODNR and Fish and Wildlife and Office of Surface Mines to get grants to try and mitigate some of that. We will probably, you know, not probably, but as we have the campground open, we're going to open up more of that North Country to some of our guests as well, to hiking and biking trails. So yeah, we have lots of plans, but we will never forget our goal of restoring this land to what it used to be.
Doug Swift, we heard from Dorothy Montgomery, absolutely loves the wilds, love what they've done there. What do you get generally from the residents in that part of Muskingum County about the wilds?
Well, at least the people I talked to who used to live there, Hal Burlingame would be another person. He grew up on a farm that was where the giraffe barn is now, and it's a similar. Most people didn't have Dorothy's father and didn't stay. Like, they got pushed out, and so they went through a process. And Hal would use the word trauma. It was traumatic, mm-hmm. you know, to go through that with a coal company and kind of feel like you got your farm taken away from you and not get a fair value for it. And whatever came next. So in that case, it's healing. You know, it's really healing. And I think that is representative of what this, what the Wilds represents in the story, like why I think it's a good story and why I think the story is kind of a parable just of the human relationship with nature. Mm-hmm. I mean, not because we're bad people, but in most of human history, at least fairly modern human history, we just kind of took what we wanted because we needed it without much thinking about what
the next
meant,
generation,
you know,
gets,
or what the consequences of that are. And now we know more, and we know that you can't just take infinite resources from the earth. You know, there's a toll that takes. And so the fact that this latter chapter is about conservation is what I think makes the story so profound. So the fact that for Hal, it so visibly was a healing thing to come back and know I can't recognize my farm. That topography is gone. The topography of my childhood is gone. I can't recognize it. You know, imagine what that does to you psychologically. But what's here is kind of beautiful.
Dr. Jan Raymer, we talked earlier about the Edina mound that's still located on the property. I just want to make sure I've got that right. Mm-hmm. How are you managing that particular aspect of the 10,000 acres?
Now, that's a great question and something that our ecology department is working on right now. It has really not been a feature that we have spent a lot of time around yet, but one that I think that we can figure out how to honor and highlight with our guests and highlight the history of the region beyond, you know, we have a plaque up for the Lett family, but I think we need to go further back and honor the history of the region. And that mound would be a perfect way to do that. So we're working on that as we speak.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to go back to something that you and Doug were talking about. And you know, we're working hard to try to give back to communities as well. And one of the ways we do that is just through economic impact. And we just did a new economic impact study through the Voinovich School down at OU. And we now, based on our 2021 statistics, have a $26 million impact on the region. So that's one small way that we can try to give back is through that economy.
How far away do people travel? I mean, how are they? Where do they come from?
Yeah, great question. Most of our guests do come from Ohio, many from the Columbus area, but we are seeing guests also from Pittsburgh, from West Virginia, so regionally, as you would expect. But there's recently been a television program on Nat Geo Wild, and we are starting to see we've seen people from every state now coming in because we've had a little bit of exposure nationally.
And any particular struggles at this point?
Struggles at this point, I guess, you know, I mean, finances are always a struggle to finance all of the things that we want to do. So we're always looking at ways to improve, and we're always looking for grant opportunities. One of the good things about being a former strip mine is that we are eligible for more grants than a traditional zoo. And so that's, I wouldn't say it's a struggle exactly, but it's always on our minds is how do we fund the wonderful things that we want to do.
And I only have a few seconds left, but you worked in Africa before coming to Ohio, so I'm wondering what your impression was and what you're expecting and how it compares.
Oh my gosh. Well, yes, I did work in Africa right before I came to Ohio. And, you know, if I can't be in Africa doing that work, the Wilds is a really, really great compromise.
That's a
wonderful place.
Well put. Dr. Jan Raymer, Senior Vice President of Animal Care and Conservation at the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium and at the Wilds in Muskingum County. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And Doug Swift, director of the documentary 10,000 Acres, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Jan. Appreciate it.
Everybody else, thanks for listening. Thanks to the All Sides staff, senior producer Marcus Charleston, assistant producer Bobby Gerberick, our interns, Evan Clark and Molly Teller, video production by the Ohio Channel, board operation by Bobby Gerberick, Alan DiCenzo is a composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. And remember to check. We'll have a link to the web documentary produced by Doug Swift, 10,000 Acres, at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.